companies and sort of follow up and check their engineering and make sure that the car was done right. But there never was a body engineering department as such. Everything was really very small. I think there were only three women that worked there.
Really?
Yeah, there was a girl by the name of I think her first name was Fran. She was a red-headed girl that was on the switchboard and also the receptionist. And she was Harold Ames' secretary. And I think she also wrote letters for Harold, for Pearl Watson, if he ever had any letters to write. And then there was a girl by the name of Catherine Finneran that worked in the accounting department. She was secretary to the chief accountant. I mean, that was it. And then there was a Mrs. Hadley, who was a bookkeeper. And that's how big the thing was. It was really very, very small. And Ames had a man by the name of Vance Hall, who was sales manager. He had a little office. And then we had a man by the name of Shirley Mitchell, who was the traveling mechanic. And
the roadman.
He would, if somebody in Denver had a Duesenberg engine that needed work on it, why, they would send him out there and he would do the work right there. And I can't recall the name of his boss. There was another man who was, I've got it in my diary somewhere, but I can't look it up right now, who was the service manager.
Did Mr. Cord, was he still alive at this time?
Oh, he was alive, but mm-hmm. He was never around.
He was never around the Duesenberg.
No, according to Ames, Mr. Cord used to come down on Sunday, mm-hmm. But I never saw him there.
Well, thank you. Could we then continue your career narrative where we left off?
All right. Mm-hmm. We were in 1934, I believe.
Right.
Well, in 1934, after the 35 Auburn and the 35 Auburn Speedster designs were finished, the company finally decided to do something with the small Duesenberg design that we had worked out. And Denny Duesenberg and I brought it up to Auburn one night. And but they wanted to redesign it and make it a front-wheel drive, and it was going to be called a Cord. So we got started on that, and we decided to do the work in quarter-scale clay model work. And it took us several weeks to finish this. But, and then Labor Day weekend, I had a date with an Auburn girl and fell in love and decided to get married, and we got married in December. But anyway, this period of, say, from the middle of the summer up until December, we were very active on the new Cord project, which eventually became the Model 810 and 812. And by the time I got married, December 22nd, and left for Florida on a honeymoon, I had some Packard stock that I sold, and I spent the money in Florida on a honeymoon. And but anyway, I left Auburn feeling that everything was in great shape, because we had completed the cord design, and the full-size body drafts were made on it, finished, and the die models were pretty well finished. And we had made a clay model of the cord fed. Mm-hmm. So I thought everything was going along fine, and the car was going to be introduced the following year, which would have given us a pretty good period of time for developing the chassis and testing it and so forth. And when I got back from Florida, I found out that while I was gone, the whole program had been scrapped.
For what reason?
I don't know. They never explained that to me, except that they had ideas on how they could do it cheaper. And one engineer thought that we could put the new cord front end on the old Auburn body, which was a horrible thing. We had to build a model to prove it. And then they wanted another model made where they used the cord body and put a conventional front end on it, and that looked even worse. And then we did a sports car called an Auburn Gentleman Speedster, which was an attempt to find a market to use up some leftover 12-cylinder engines. So all of these things just ate up time. And so we lost about at least 6 months when nothing went on the cord program. Mm. And then in the middle of the summer, they decided to go ahead with the cord program, and they had to have 100 cars built by the time of the auto shows, which they built by hand. And they built one prototype car, and George Kublin drove it to California and back. Mr. Cord was living in Beverly Hills in California. So they drove this car out and showed it to him and drove it back. And Kublin turned in his report, which said that they had a problem with cooling. And they also had a transmission problem. The car would pop out of gear under full torque. But they had no chance to change anything and still make the deadline. So they built these cars and showed them in the auto show. They didn't have transmissions in them because the transmission hadn't been redesigned yet. We showed a convertible model that the top mechanism had not been worked out, but the disappearing top. So we just told the press that the top was in there, but it was a disappearing top. And they got the car was a sensation at the auto show, and they got lots of orders. But we were far away from being able to produce the car and to produce a good car. And so when the first cars came out, they still had problems with the transmission, and they had problems with cooling. And it was an expensive automobile. And the competition never helped us any. They would tell their customers that Auburn Cord Duesenberg was going to go out of business, and you didn't want to spend that money and buy an orphan automobile. You wouldn't be able to get service on it, and so forth. And so it was rough going. And but they did continue building cars in 36 and 37. And they corrected their errors, and by the time they finished building the cars in 37, they were pretty good automobiles. They still had a few bugs in them, but they were pretty good cars. But the thing that really, in my opinion, killed the company was that 6 months time when they lost everything. Nothing happened during that 6 month period. And had we had they not done that, we would have had a good car, I think, and the whole outcome would have been different.
When was that six-month period?
It was the first 6 months of 1935.
Mm-hmm. When you had a hiatus?
When what?
When you had a lag between the production. Yeah.
Yeah. From, they stopped the thing while I was in Florida between Christmas and New Year's, and I think it was the following July before they picked up the program again. Mm. And then they had to have cars in the show in November, I think it was.
How was the Auburn division doing at that time?
They were doing fairly well.
Were they?
Yeah. 35 Auburn sold pretty well.
Was this upon your career where you decided to go elsewhere?
Well, when the company had moved its facilities from Auburn to Connersville.
Mm-hmm. Still in Indiana.
Connersville, Indiana, and that's where they built the company called Central Manufacturing. It was an old factory that Cord picked up cheap. Mm-hmm. And according to some of the publicity, it was a very modern plant with modern equipment. That's not true. When I left there, I went to the Bud Company and saw some really modern equipment. And so the equipment in Auburn was really not bad, but not compared to what you would have at the Bud Company or Briggs Manufacturing or Fisher Body. And anyway, there was no real designing to be done. Everything had been finished. I mean, all the design work of anything that ever got in production was all done. But I had to go to Connersville, and I would come home on weekends, and it was a pretty bleak situation. So I started looking around, and I made a connection with the Bud Company and came up and started a design department in Detroit for the Bud Company.
Did you? Mm-hmm. That was in 1935?
No, probably 1938.
Oh, 38.
37 or 38, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did that come about?
I mean, the Bud Company?
Right. Your connection with it.
Well, there was a fellow named Ed Disley who was chief engineer, and I talked with him, and he said that Ed Budd Jr. was interested in building a design department. I went to Philadelphia and got the job, and then we designed and built a department at Budd.
They not had a formal...
They hadn't had one prior to that. They had a chap by the name of Davenport who was a designer, but he was a wheel designer.
Mm.
He worked for the wheel division. And Dave Davenport. So he was not connected with our group at all. And so we started this new department in Detroit. And we're going pretty well there, and Bud was happy with what we were doing, but...
You were supplying the automobile industry.
Well, that was what it was for.
Mm-hmm.
See, the Briggs Company had a good department, and Bud thought that was a way to get into body business, because all we were building at that time were truck bodies. We built truck bodies for Ford, and we were building truck bodies, I believe it was, for Dodge, and we were building doors for Packard. Now, why, I don't know, but we were building doors for Packard. And we tried to get some business with Willys. We designed a car for them, and we designed some stuff for Ford. But the problem we had was that there was a sales manager there by the name of Alexander. he didn't want us to be there.
Mm.
He was very much against our operation. And he referred to us as Junior's Hobby Shop. Edward Budd was Edward Budd Jr.
Mm-hmm.
So he referred to us as, and he was in Philadelphia. But anyway, he referred to our shop as Junior's Hobby Shop. And he refused to bring any customers in to show him what we were doing. His idea of salesmanship was to take purchasing agents on hunting trips up north and supply them with any kind of entertainment they wanted. That was the way to sell stuff. And so I finally got mad and wrote Bud Jr. a letter and told him I thought it was wasting my time and his money, and so that was the end of it. I got fired when I did that.
Really?
Yeah. I was the foolish thing to do. I should have held out. Eventually, I probably could have outlived Alexander, and maybe things would have worked out all right. Because it was, we had an ideal situation there. We had good people working with me, and we had a free rein of things to do. And Ed Budd Jr. was happy with what we were doing, but I messed it up. And then I went into a period of depression where I tried a number of things I don't particularly like to talk about. I went back to Auburn and I tried to make it as a independent industrial designer. And then, let's see, I was working for one of my clients was the King Sealy Corporation in Ann Arbor. And I finally moved to Ann Arbor. I was still working as a consultant to them when the war happened. And then I went to San Diego and worked in the engineering department of Consolidated Aircraft. I was there for about 6 months. They were very much in need of engineers. So I got in touch with a friend of mine by the name of Dale Cosper, who had been part of my team at Auburn and a brilliant engineer. Tried to get him to come out. Well, I found out he was working in Akron, Ohio for the Goodyear Aircraft Company. And was doing better than I was doing in California. He persuaded me to come to Akron. So I came to Akron and worked for Goodyear. And in descriptive drawings for aircraft assembly. And then that sort of ran out, and then I finally wound up as the mathematician for a group of tool engineers. And that was rather interesting. And then I left there finally, and I worked for Harold Ames at LaPorte, Indiana.
Had he left the company by then?
Yeah.
Into independent design?
And they were making aircraft sub-assemblies. And then shortly after that, the war in Germany was over, but the Japanese war was still on. I ran across a friend of mine by the name of Carl Otto, who was an associate of Raymond Loewy Associates. And Loewy was building up a design department at Studebaker. And he hired me to head up this group and to build up a larger department. And I hired some old friends like John Reinhardt, Jack Aldrich and Bob Cotto, and Virge Exner was there. Virge had been there before I was, and Virge was my assistant. And then Loewy came out from New York one day and got mad at me and made Exner the manager and made me his assistant. And then in another period he came out and fired Exner and put me in charge. I mean, it was a funny political situation.
A volatile personality, to say the least.
Yeah. So anyway, then the fiasco of the post-war Studebaker, which Exner had designed in his basement, and the full-size body was built by Bud in Philadelphia and brought out. And this was all a political scheme by the chief engineer who was trying to get rid of Loewy. And
is this the Studebaker setup?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when Loewy came out and found out about it, he fired Exner. Roy Cole was the chief engineer, and then Roy hired him and started their own department out at the proving grounds. And then Loewy thought I was involved in this skullduggery, which I was not involved in at all, but he fired me. And then I got involved in a company called the Tasco Company in the East.
T-A-S-C-O?
Yeah, it was supposed to be the Sports Car Company of America. And built a prototype car. We built the body down at Durham Body Company.
Durham was in
Rosemont, Pennsylvania.
Rosemont.
And that was a failure. But the interesting thing about it was that that was the first car that had a T-top on it. That was where they invented the T-top.
This was your invention?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when the company folded, they owed me some money, and I said, well, I wanted the rights to that top.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went ahead at my own expense and got patents on the T-top. And I don't know, then years went by and we managed to get three meals a day, but we didn't do very well. And then finally I got this job with Ford Motor, and that was in 49, I believe it was.
How did that come about, Mr.
Gray? Well, John Oswald, who used to be with Auburn, was the body engineer, and at that time styling was under body engineering, and there was a man by the name of George Snyder who was a designer, and I was interviewed by Oswald, and then a period went by and John said, well, I can't bring you in yet, and I finally found out that Snyder didn't want me in there. Anyway, finally Snyder was fired or left or something, and I came in, and they put me in charge of a studio called the Body Development Studio. And it was in this studio that the models other than the sedan were to be developed. And the first project we had was on the 52 Ford, which the sedan had been approved. And I think Joe, or no, who, can't recall who was in charge of that studio. Anyway, they did the two-door and the four-door sedan models. And then it was our job to design the convertible and the station wagon using maximum interchangeability with the sheet metal from the sedan. And Earl McPherson was the vice president in charge of engineering. And
all these people had been GM men, hadn't they?
Yeah.
Brought over by Ernie Breach, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And anyway, turn it up. The 1950 and 51 station wagons were financial catastrophe to the Ford Motor Company. They were built at Iron Mountain, the old wood style station wagons. They only had one model, which was a two-door, and anyway, they wanted a new line of station wagons, and Chevrolet had come out with a imitation wooden body made out of steel, and so McPherson told me that's what he wanted me to do, but they wanted a four-door and a two-door, and but it wanted to look like the Chevrolet model, and fortunately he left right after that to go to Florida for a month's vacation. And while he was in Florida, we did what he asked us to do, but we also did a new line of cars in which we were more honest, and we had we brought out a car called the Ranch Wagon, which was had no wood or imitation wood on it. And we had the Country Squire, I think it was. I don't remember the exact names of that the PR people put on this. But anyway, we came up with a series of station wagons, and those were built for the next 3 years. And in 1951, the company produced 7,000 station wagons, and it went from there to 140,000 station wagons. And the 51 station wagon had the reputation of being the worst car on the used car market of any car in the line. And the exact opposite was true after we came out with our new line of cars. And then the other thing that we did in that department at that time was General Motors were building a car called a hardtop convertible, which was a misnomer because it was not a convertible, but it was a hardtop coupe with convertible type windows, and they were very popular. And the sales department was very unhappy that Ford didn't have a model like that, because General Motors were making lots of money on it. So we designed one for the 1952 series, and that was designed by the sedan group. The Ford Studio did a 52 station, a 52 hardtop coupe. But the dealers, this was still late 50, and the dealers were really screaming. They wanted that sooner. They wanted to know if we could have one in 51. So John Oswald came in one day and said, "Can you take a convertible, 51 convertible, and make it into a hardtop. Well, of course, you already had the windows for the door and the quarter window, so it was just a matter of doing a new top for it. And we did it with a band of metal up over the rear window, which gave it corrugated window. And we did that model very fast. We had a quarter scale clay model that someone else had built of the convertible, and we brought it into our studio and quickly transformed it into this model. And it sat there for several days, and one day I came in and it was gone. And I inquired about it and found out that it had been sent out to a job shop, and they were engineering and tooling it for a production. And I later found out that George Walker, who was a consultant at that time, claimed credit for it, and he had nothing to do with it at all. So it was shortly after that Oswald's plan to get Walker out of the company failed, and Breech brought Walker in as the vice president in charge of styling and fired Oswald. And at that time, Emmett Judge, who was product planning at Lincoln Mercury, offered me a raise to come over and work for him. So I did that, and from then on I was never allowed back in styling for the next 14 years.
You were in product planning all that time, more or less?
No, I got into engineering, Ford engineering, and then finally into research. And the last 4 or 5 years I was at a very, very small group, and we were doing research into the use of plastics in Ford products. And that's where I was working when I retired.
What sort of projects did you do for Emmett Judge and Lincoln Mercury at that point?
One of the things that I did when I was working for Emmett Judge was organization plan for the Mark II Continental, which Doug McClure told me that when he made his pitch to the company, he used pretty much what I had written in the suggestion of a special group to do a new Continental. The company was interested in a new Continental, and they had had some very wild and very ugly suggestions on what a new Continental should look like. And then they organized a new special products division under Bill Ford. And we had probably the greatest organization that Ford ever had. And it's too bad that the whole thing blew up.
Can you describe that a bit in a few minutes?
Well,
the special products set up.
The special products division was in the old trade school.
Mm-hmm. On Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
And they hired John Reinhart to be the chief body designer. And Harley Kopp was the chief engineer. And he offered me the job of chief body engineer. Mm-hmm. And I told him that, you know, that was, I had been out of body engineering for a good many years. In fact, the last time I really worked in body engineering was when they were building wooden bodies. But it was either a case of taking that job or not being in on the program. So, and he said, well, you get plenty of help. And I thought, well, I knew the basics of body engineering, so I took the job as chief body engineer. And we organized this thing and got started. And one of the first engineers I hired was chap by the name of Jess Richards. And I got him from Kaiser Frazier. Mm-hmm. And that company was folding. And one of the rules we had in building up our group was that we couldn't hire anybody from Ford. We had to go to the outside for all our new help.
Why was that, I wonder?
It was just a rule. It came down from on high, mm-hmm. that we couldn't hire anybody from any other part of Ford Motor. Mm-hmm. And we got two or three people from Kaiser Frazier, which was folding up. And Jess Richards was such a brilliant engineer that after he had been there about a week or 10 days, I went into Harley Cobb and I said, "Harley, I need an assistant, and this is the man I want." And Harley said, "Well, why don't you wait a week or so and think about it?" I said, "I don't have to think about it. This guy is good." Well, I was right, because he later became chief body engineer of Ford Motor. And so Jess really carried the ball as far as detail engineering was concerned. My contributions were in the development of the car. We did it right. We did it the way it should be done. We had a new frame, and we wanted to have a good test period with the new chassis. And Bob Regenhardt had designed the frame, and we built some prototype bodies down at Hessen-Eisenhardt in Cincinnati. And the nearest thing I came to getting to do any kind of designing was that I got to design the cobbled cars. Mm. And this was a matter of taking the sheet metal from Lincoln and changing the proportions on it and cobbling up these test cars. And they turned out to be real good-looking automobiles. Mm-hmm. And we also built a convertible there. And then we had we developed a system of making sheet metal parts on a scale model out of plastic, a vacuum forming process, which I'd introduced to Ford back when I was in Ford Styling. And
was this still a relatively new technique?
Well, they built a whole big department to do it. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to when I was in styling at Ford. This would be in 1950. Charlie Waterhouse was after Oswald, Charlie Waterhouse became a chief body engineer. And he wanted me to, no, he was in styling, that's right. Anyway, he was an engineer. His family owned the old Waterhouse custom body farm.
Oh, yes.
And every week they had a meeting in a conference room, and for the engineers, body engineers. And you had body engineers from Lincoln Mercury and from Ford and from production engineering. And the purpose of the meeting was to iron out differences in the procedures for building the automobile. Lincoln Mercury had one plan. They wanted to use what they called a balloon type of assembly. The Ford engineers and the Lincoln Mercury engineers had two ideas about how to put the body together, and they were building the same body.
And this was for what model?
This would have been for the 52.
Right.
And so Ford always won out because they were the company that made money, and Lincoln Mercury was the division that lost money. So the Ford engineers had more clout. But anyway, I had to go to every one of these meetings and sit through them. And my purpose in doing that was to bring to Charlie Waterhouse's attention any deviation in the manufacturing process which would cause a change in the styling. As long as it didn't affect styling, why, it didn't matter what they did. But if it affected styling, then I had to raise my voice or bring it to Charlie's attention so something could be done about it. And Henry Grebe was the chief body engineer at that time of the Ford division. During the next 14 years at Ford, I was lived a life of somewhat frustration because my talent and training was in body design, and I was not allowed into styling the building.
May I ask you at this point why that was so?
Well, it was George Walker didn't want me in there. Mm-hmm. He was the vice president.
Right.
So anyway, I did what I could, and I fortunately had enough engineering talent to do things that were worthwhile. And one of the most important things that I got into was the use of plastics in automobiles. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. I had a very small group, about five people. And we went through the whole car. And we had one criteria that we would work to, and that is that we'd study a component. This was both chassis and body work. That it had to be, if it was made in plastic, it had to be a better part. It had to be lighter, and it had to be cheaper. If it didn't fit all three things, we didn't consider it. But most of the things that have gone into plastics in the last few years were things that we did evaluate at that time. And we made several test trips out in the desert. We had one of the drawbacks in the use of plastics at that time was that there was very little data available on exactly what conditions a plastic part would have to withstand.
Was this in the mid-50s you were doing this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took a Ford station wagon and rigged it up with a bunch of thermocouples at about 30 different points in the car where we could measure temperatures. And this was under the hood as well as on top of the cowl and all over the different body. And another fellow and I took the car out in the desert, and we worked and established a whole background of critical temperatures. And then typical of things that went on, somebody else gave the presentation to Society of Automotive Engineers, and that data I think is still being used. And
you didn't get any credit for that.
No, but we also did we're going to run a test up in Bemidji, Minnesota to find out what the critical temperatures were at the other end of the scale. And that didn't work out very well. They had an accident on the way up, and I didn't go on the trip. But I remember that after one of our trips to Arizona, I made several, we were trying to find maximum temperatures. And believe it or not, it was hotter in Detroit than it was in Arizona. And we would get the weather temperature and we'd go to Flagstaff or we'd go to different places and try to find maximum temperature. Mostly we worked out of Phoenix where they had facilities. But then we went down to, this was on the Mark II Continental program. Wait a minute, I'm thinking of something else now. But I remember we went down to New Orleans and we were testing air conditioning. And we would get up in the morning, go out, start a test, and before we'd finish, it'd start raining and wash out the test, and we'd try again the next day. So we came back, and I made a presentation to Mike Ferentz, who was the head of research.
Scientific lab.
And told him that no one enjoyed test trips more than I did, but that it seemed to me that everything that we did could be done in the laboratory and done more accurately, and you'd have the same conditions every day rather than trying to depend on the weather. And I don't know whether that had any effect on them, but eventually they have done that. So most of the, because everything that you can create, I mean every condition you can run into in Arizona, you can duplicate in a wind tunnel with proper equipment. And you have it under complete control, and it's the same thing every time. But you go out to Arizona or Colorado or those places, you are subject to the weather. And they are a lot of fun, but not as productive as they should be. I remember one thing that happened. Fred Hooven was a very good friend of mine and had a much bigger job at Ford than I did. He worked for Mike Ferentz. Henry Ford asked him, this was in 1960. He asked him to project 20 years ahead what was going to happen, and so that they could plan their facilities and so forth. Well, Mike was a scientist, but he had very little background in automobiles. So he asked Fred Hooven to do this thing for him. It would go to Henry Ford under Mike's signature, but Fred did it. And Fred is an old friend of mine, and he wanted, respected my opinion. So he, this may have been prior to 1960. Anyway, it was projecting 20 years in the future. And Fred brought it out to me and asked me to read it over the weekend and come in Monday morning and criticize it before he turned it into Mike Ferentz. So I did this, and when I turned it in on Monday morning, I said that, you know, it was a very thorough study. And I said, I think there's one thing you've missed. He said, what's that? I said, you haven't said anything about the Japanese. And he said, well, they're not building automobiles. And I said, no, they're not building automobiles, but they're building motorcycles, they're building cameras, and there's no reason why they can't build automobiles. Well, he hadn't thought of that. And I don't know whether that went into the report or not, but it was a pretty good forecast.
Yeah.
I remember another thing that happened. This was when I was working out at the Ford Division on Plymouth Road, I think it was. Bob McNamara was head of the Ford Division at that time. And I was trying to get the company to get interested in a small car. And I finally got them, they did buy a Volkswagen and they boarded it. They took it apart and boarded it. And so Will Scott was head of product planning. And Will asked me to make some sketches of future cars, layouts of various kinds. I made several with front-wheel drive small cars. And Chalmers Goyert was my boss, and he told me one day, he said, "What's all this business about front-wheel drive?" He said, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "Well, it makes the best package for a small car." He said, "Well, forget it. Ford Motor will never build a front-wheel drive automobile." Anyway, I was trying to get, there was a man there that was, I don't recall his name, but he was pretty high in the company. And he was their crystal ball expert. He was forecasting the future. And I went and talked to him, and I said, "Can't you give me some support on this small car program?" And he said, "Well, Gordon, that's only 0.5% of the market. It will never go above 2% of the total market." So he said, "You might as well forget it." He said, "Americans don't like small cars." So the problem was they didn't pay me enough money to listen to me. Well, anyway, let's go back to during the period when I was working in plastics. This was the last 3 or 4 years. I got to travel quite a bit to the different plastics companies. Got to know them well. And of course, when you traveled as a representative of Ford Motor Company, you always had the red carpet treatment. You always met with the heads of the company and were treated royally. But I got to know them all pretty well. And so one year, I forget, it was about 1963 or 64, we had to turn in a budget for the following year, and I turned in a budget for $125,000 to run my little group for the next year. I figured we had to have that much money to do anything that was important. Well, that was cut from $125,000 to $25,000. So I had $25,000 to run the department. And so we bought a Falcon, I think it was, Ford Falcon. And then I went to these friends of mine in the different plastics companies, and I said, "Look, we're going to run a test trip. And if you have any new material that you don't want to talk about, but it's experimental, we'll let you have one component on the automobile. And we don't want you to tell us what it is. And when the test results are in, we'll send you test results. But there will be other companies making parts for the same car, different components, and we won't tell you what their parts are or what their tests, how their tests turn out." So this way it took all the expense away from us and put it on the plastics company. And Uniroyal built the hood. DuPont Plastics Division did one door, and their Latin America division did another door. A company in California did the deck lid. Union Carbide did one of the front fenders. And I think Monsanto did a front fender. Mm. So we had this car all rigged up with these plastic parts. And as I say, I didn't know what the materials were, and I didn't want to know. I didn't want any information. All I wanted to do was run the tests and then turn in the reports. So I took the car out by myself, out to Arizona, and stayed in a hotel in Scottsdale. And I had some steel scales with me and things that I could test with. We were testing for thermal expansion of materials, for one thing. And so I ran tests between Scottsdale over to Yuma, Arizona, and up to Palm Springs, then back to Scottsdale. And in that triangle, I made that route several times. And it was in August, the hottest part of the summer. Temperatures well over 100 degrees every day. And got all the data that I wanted. And then there was one test that... you want to show? There was one test that we really wanted to run, and that was the aging of the plastics in the sun. And so there was an old boss of mine, by the name of Chase Morrissey, mm-hmm. who had been in the product planning group. And Chase had left the company, but he was in charge of had taken over a dealership in Scottsdale, mm-hmm. Ford dealership. So I drove in and saw Chase, and I said, what I'd like to do is to leave this car with you for a month and just leave it out in the sun. And I said, you can use it or you can let people use it. It doesn't matter that, but keep it in the sun. Don't keep it in the shade. We want to see how these plastic parts turn up. And then after a month, we'll ship it back to Detroit. Well, about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from Chase Morrissey, and he said that the car had been all smashed up, that a mechanic had taken it out and had a bad accident, and the car was smashed up. And I told him not to worry about it too much, because that was going to be the final test anyway.
Perfect.
But we did learn a lot from that.
Did you?
Yeah.
Can you detail any of the findings that you...
Well, DuPont had a process that they had a lot of faith in, and it had a basic fault, and I think that our tests there sort of, they dropped the program after that, but they had spent a lot of money on it. And it was a process where they would form a skin of acrylic over a painted surface, but we got delamination in the thing, and so it sort of helped there. The one program that we had was the trunk lid, which there was a man in California who had invented a process of linear alignment of fiberglass. And his company, their main business was building equipment for airports. But he also was building liners for cargo ships, for cargo airplanes.
Right.
And they were using this process for that. And he had been an engineer on the original DC-3 airplane. A real nice, experienced engineer. And so his process was expensive. But what intrigued me about it was you could build a very strong component that was extremely light. And at that period in time, Ford was interested in racing. Mm-hmm. And in racing stock cars, the rules are pretty sloppy. The main thing is it has to look like an automobile. Mm-hmm. But it, I thought we could build a Ford car by this process that would look exactly like a Ford car and probably weigh a tenth as much as far as the body was concerned. So we built this deck lid, which was spring-loaded with torsion bars, and if you turned the key, the thing would flop up like a mousetrap. And that never got off the ground, that program, because Ford got out of racing at that time, or as far as public relations were concerned, got out of racing. The program was dropped. But I don't remember what else we gained from that program.
Certainly it was one of the very early,
it was an early
production experiments.
Yeah, it was a very... Well, another thing that happened was that about 6 months before I retired, I did take early retirement because I was, as soon as I saw that I had enough money to live on, I wanted to retire. Mm-hmm. I was in California, and Mr. Adams, who ran the Art Center College of Design, I went out to see him, and he said, I told him I was thinking about retiring, and he said, would you like to come out and teach a course in plastics? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, we want our product designers to know, have a basic knowledge of the use of plastics and the different materials that are on the market, and we don't want them to become plastics experts, we just want them to know, be knowledgeable about the materials and where to use them and where to get information when they're working on a plastic product. And he said, do you think you could get the your friends in the plastics industry to underwrite your program? And he said, why don't you talk to them? And he said, this would be the proposition. He said, get like to have five companies, no, four, we'd like to have four companies. He said, four companies that would contribute $5,000 a year to Art Center, and half of that will be your salary. So I would get $10,000, and I would work one day a week giving this course. But he said, you want to impress on them that that's not the end of their obligation. They have to send lecturers out to lecture to our class and present their materials. So that, he said, this would be a two-way street, because then when these fellows graduate, they will be familiar with the products, the different plastic products of these four companies. So I did this. I went to different companies, and I didn't hear from anybody for few weeks, and finally I got a call one day from a fellow named Shaw, who was sales manager at DuPont. Can't think of his first name right now. He lives out in Carefree, Arizona now. Anyway, Shaw called me and he said, Gordon, he said, we're going to go with you. He said, when you first made your presentation to us, he said, I never had heard of the school, but he said, we like you, and he said, we decided that just we owed it to you, we would check into it. So he said, we did. And when we found out that 67% of the personnel in Detroit in styling came from this school. He said, we decided to do it. So after that, I got in touch with the other companies, and they all went along. And so I had a 5-year contract out there to teach this course in plastics. And that brought me up to 1970.
Before we leave your Ford career, did you have any input into the Continental program while you were there at Lincoln Mercury?
You mean the Mark II?
Yeah, Mark II.
Oh, yeah, I was sure.
I'm not sure we've talked too much about that program.
Well, the I had 8 project engineers. Each one was assigned to a different part of the car. Mm-hmm. There's a fellow named Pulley Blank who had the windshield cowl area. Mitch Wayne was, I had Mitch Wayne in charge of the plastic prototype program. And Maury Fordyce was in charge of trim. And I just can't recall all of them. Anyway, building the Mark II Continental was a problem for purchasing because the regular suppliers of Ford Motor were not interested in building parts for the Mark II because it was very small production. Mm-hmm. So we had to get new sources. Mm-hmm. And under Mitch Wayne, I had him in charge of it. We built a 3/8 scale model of the car. Mm-hmm. And then we made plaster cast of that. And from this plaster, we produced all of the exterior parts of the car in vacuum formed plastic. And so here were parts that were easy to handle. I mean, like a front fender would be maybe 2 feet long, very light in weight. We photographed all of these parts. And then we also had the inner panels, like the inner panels for the doors, and the inner panels for the hood, all this, and the assemblies, and all of this in the small size. Then we photographed all these parts, and we had orthographic drawings made of each one, which gave the overall dimension of the part and a picture of the part. And this was used by purchasing and sourcing, because they could, instead of sending out what we used to call a bed sheet, which would be a drawing as long as this room, and it would take a great deal of study to try to figure out what you wanted to know. The basic information for estimating the cost of that part, estimating the cost of tooling, and everything was shown in this picture book of these plastic parts. And I remember the plant manager told me one day, he said, that scale model of yours is worth $50,000 to me tomorrow. You know, he said, because, and they also had to plan their factory. And here on a man's desk were all the parts in a size that you could recognize and use, and yet for planning purposes, everything was done in that size. I remember that the first time they did that was back when I was in the styling group for it. This would be in 1950. Mm-hmm. And we had these engineering meetings that I referred to that I had to go to every day. And They were working on a windshield for the Lincoln, and they brought in a section of the windshield, which was about a foot and a half high, and the windshield pillar, and it was made up of about 6 or 7 pieces of steel. It was heavy, and of course would scratch the mahogany table if you weren't very careful with it. And they passed this thing around and discussed it. But the problem was that by the time they got that, they'd changed their mind and the thing was obsolete. So the pattern was, the whole thing was obsolete before they got it. And so I went to Grebe and I said, why don't you make those parts out of plastic? And he never thought of it. So I said, let me borrow this part. And so I took it home and I took it apart. And I got in touch with a friend of mine who was the vice president of U.S. Royal. And we got the wooden patterns that they had used for hammer forms for making these steel parts. I got those wooden patterns and shipped them to Chicago. And then I went over to Chicago with a man from U.S. Rubber and with the head of our shop. And we made all the parts in about a half an hour and brought them home, and I put them together in my garage and took them in the next day and showed them this part. Well, they were so impressed with this that they set up a plant in the Rouge plant to go to plastic parts for prototypes. And that all, and then, of course, we used it to a great extent on the Mark II Continental.
Which, of course, was all new and needed that kind of approach.
Yeah.
Right. Can you put together for us briefly a verbal picture of the whole team on the Mark II? You were in body engineering, largely. And,
yeah.
And what was the other end of it? Who was in charge of the so-called exterior design? And
John Reinhardt. John Reinhardt. Bob Thomas was assistant to John. He had Charlie Faneth in there, and we brought some students back from Art Center to work there through the summer on clay modeling.
About Harley Kopp, was he involved?
Kopp was chief engineer, a brilliant guy. Bob Doug McClure was sales manager, and his father was the head surgeon at Henry Ford Hospital.
Dr. McClure, of course.
Yeah, and anyway, Doug was a nice guy, and then there was a product planning guy, I can't think of his name.
Tom Case wasn't involved in that, was he?
No.
No, he wasn't.
No. And I can't remember who was the chief draftsman, body draftsman, and for production drafting, and I can't remember the name of the purchasing agent either. Should remember those. We had a wonderful group, though.
Did you?
It was the most dedicated group of people you ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the Esprit de Corps was just fantastic. I remember one secretary came in one day and she said, Mr. Burek, I was coming in and she said, you know what, she said, Mr. Ford opened the door for me. That made her day.
Of course.
You know.
Well, this was largely, in large part, due to William Clay Ford's youth and enthusiasm.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was great. And I remember one time we had a blackboard drawing of a four-door model, and Harold Ames was in town, and Harold had told me that he wanted to have the first Mark II in Chicago. So
he was your old associate from the Duesenberg.
Yeah, and so I got permission to bring him in and show him the car. I said, look, here's a man who was head of Duesenberg and certainly knows that market, and I think it'd be worthwhile to let him, and you can trust him, and let him see this thing and get his opinion. And he saw this four-door sedan job, and he said, well, that's the one to build, forget the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decided they were going to build a model like that, and it was going to have a partition in the back, so it'd be a chauffeur-driven car.
Oh, yes.
And so they had a advertising company in New York working on a name. They wanted a special name for this model. And so we'd have a meeting every Monday morning in Bill Ford's conference room. So this one day we went in there, and Bill had this big elaborate brochure that had come out of New York with a whole bunch of names for this model if we built the four-door. And Bill said, he said, personally, I don't like any of the names. And they were wild, and they'd have all this esoteric palaver about what reason why that was a good name. So I said, why don't you call it a Berlin? And well, actually, he wanted to come back the next Monday with a name. So I came in and I said, let's call it a Berlin. And I said, that sounds good. Where'd you get that name? And I said, well, that's what it happens to be. A Berlin is a limousine, a small limousine, without the pop-up seats in the back. And it's also, the front end is trimmed the same as the back end in broadcloth, rather than having the front end trimmed in leather and the back end broadcloth as the regular limos were. I said, that's called a Berlin. Well, that was what they were going to call it. They'd never heard of the name.
That harks back to the coach
sure.
tradition, doesn't it?
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you know, the advertising people now, they get completely away from the real historic names of cars. I mean, they'll call a four-door sedan a town car, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they just have no conscience at all about
mm-hmm.
using old custom body terms and on cars that where it doesn't fit at all.
Right. This tremendous esprit de corps was, however, somewhat outside the mainstream of company politics and production, was it not?
Oh yeah, they called us the country club group. I remember one time we were experimenting with a convertible. And so we had a Packard convertible, we had a Mercedes convertible. We'd go to Dearborn Inn for lunch, and we'd ride over with the top down.
Oh.
Well, evidently some jealous people high up in the company were worried that we were having too much fun at our work. And so the ruling came through that we could never go over to the Dearborn Inn anymore with the top down because it looked like we were enjoying our work too much. And you know, the secretaries used to bring in, they'd make up sandwiches and stuff and bring in, and we'd have a picnic out in the picnic lunch outdoors. And we were the only group in Ford Motor where we had girls on our bowling team, and we had girls on our golf team.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
We included the girls and everything.
Good. Was this the old trade school or the newer division?
No, this is a trade school.
Trade school, yeah.
And we had a lot of fun. Mm.
You shared quarters there for a time with the beginnings of the Edsel Group, did you not?
Mid-50s. No, I don't think so. No? I don't know. I never was involved with Edsel at all. Mm-hmm. That was Emmett Judge. And
right, yeah. Dick Craffey.
Dick Craffey, yeah.
You later had a headquarters down the street in the divisional headquarters was erected, was it not?
The
Continental Division.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Allen Park, I think just over the line in Allen Park, as I recall.
Yeah, on the freeway.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there was a degree of jealousy and animosity directed toward the division.
Well,
in a sense,
here was the problem. You had McPherson with hundreds of engineers and Styling with hundreds of people over there, and here was this little handful of people, and if we turned out an outstanding automobile, I might make the other groups look bad.
Mm-hmm. And you did turn out an outstanding automobile, relatively so.
Well, as far as engineering and design, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where did it founder? What happened?
One of the things that Harley Kopp wanted to do was to have each project engineer be responsible for that part of the car. And when the cars were being built, these guys were supposed to be out there watching to see that part of the car was built right. And Maury Fordyce, for instance, in charge of trim, if he found something wasn't right, he could stop the line. Pulley Blank, if he saw the welds were not correct on the welding up this thing, he could stop the line. And of course, our thought was that we wanted to build the best car in the world. This was our ambition. And I remember when we were writing specifications for plating, and I put through some specs, and I got a call from the purchasing department, and they said, "This is ridiculous." And I said, "You can get plating this good." "Yeah, but it's going to be terribly expensive." I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Do you know that your specifications are above Cadillac?" And I said, "We're not building a Cadillac." And this was the attitude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they brought in a man from Mercury who had the Mercury's quality was the worst in the industry at that time. They brought this production man in from Mercury to build our car. And once they got excited about it, they wanted to make money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The original thought was that we were going to build the finest car in the world, and if we made money, that would be fine. If we broke even, that would be fine. Even if we lost money, it'd be fine. We still wanted to establish the finest car in the world, and we knew that with the small production, that even if you made money, it wasn't going to make enough money to mean anything to Ford Motor Company.
Right.
So really our goal was more or less to break even, and but to really build a fine automobile. And then they put this man in from Mercury, and the idea was, let's get the cars out, let's get the money coming in. And they just were not, they didn't have that quality. That was what killed it.
You wanted a limited production prestige automobile.
Well, I wouldn't say limited production. You build as many as you could that people wanted to buy, but try to build the finest automobile you could build, regardless of cost.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like putting in a stainless steel exhaust system, for instance. We wanted a car that you could drive for, say, 25,000 miles before anything would happen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been done. We could have built a car that well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time I went over to Dearborn Inn, and with some group, and there was a Continental sitting there, Mark II Continental, and a Volkswagen. And I made the comment, I said, if we built this thing as well as they built a Volkswagen, we'd still be in business. And I pointed out that the fits were better on the Volkswagen than they were on the Mark II Continental. So it's a shame because, and a lot of us got hurt by this whole program, but probably Bill Ford got hurt more than any of us. Because he was dedicated. He wanted to build the finest car in the world. And we all felt that way.
Partly as a memorial to his father, do you think?
No, I think Bill Ford was a perfectionist. And he just wanted the prestige automobile. He wanted the finest car in the world. And we could have done it. It left us alone.
Without going into too detailed into personalities, what was... the first year came out, and it was a critical success, the 1956, and the 57 was an improved model, as much as you could under the circumstances. Then what happened?
I don't really know. I don't remember. No, I really don't remember this part.
There obviously were forces in the company who were working for your demise.
I got out of it and moved into another area. Jess Richards, really, was so much smarter than I was as far as body engineering was concerned that once the car was in production, he was really the chief engineer. I'm glad that. I mean, I don't know, he may have been hurt by it too, but he finally at least came to the top as chief body engineer of Ford Motor. And I see Jess quite often, and he's a wonderful guy, but I'm disappointed in him that he doesn't care anything about automobiles anymore.
Really?
He just seems to have lost interest in automobiles. He likes to travel and take it easy and enjoy retirement, but I don't know, I'm so crazy about automobiles that retirement doesn't diminish my interest in cars at all. But I don't know.
We left you at in 1970 with your decision to retire from Ford.
I retired in 1965.
65?
Yeah, 1965 I retired. And then I taught school at Art Center from 65 to 70. And then my wife died. And I remarried, moved back to West Point.
And have you been effectively retired since then? Was that your last professional
I've done some consulting work. And, and we did this car called the Buick Automobile a couple of years ago.
Tell us about that, could you?
Well, it was a well-meaning thing that didn't turn out well. Dick Kuhn, who is a very brilliant man and very wealthy, was over at our house one night, and I had this model of a car that I'd made in my basement, and it was made from a Corvette, and he said, well, let's build it, and so we started a company, and he wanted me to run a company, and I said, no, I didn't want to do that, and I recommended a fellow to do it, which Dick hired, and that didn't turn out very well, and he got fired, and then things dragged on, and finally they did build one, and we built three of them.
Did you?
Yeah.
Can you describe it?
Well, they were shown in the auto show, and it was for that specialty market. Beautiful car, I'm proud of it, but it didn't sell, and the reason was that the price was $135,000 a copy, and we originally thought it was going to be about $60,000, and I think that it would have sold well at $80,000, but $135,000 was ridiculous, plus the fact that at that time...
What year was that, by the way?
A couple of years ago. there had been very little testing on the car. It wasn't a thoroughly...